Life of Jesus, a devotional study by Melva Purkis. Chapter 6, The Call of Matthew. During his stay in Capernaum, Jesus spent most of his time by the lakeside, healing and teaching the multitudes who resorted to him from every quarter. One day he approached the custom house set at a strategic point outside the town, where the famous Way of the Sea joined the Lake of Galilee. The official in charge of this post was an unpopular Jew named Matthew. All who furthered Rome's interest in Palestine were hated by the great majority of their countrymen, but particularly the class of publican to which Matthew belonged. For there were two types actively engaged in collecting money for the occupying power at that time. The tax gatherers were responsible for the normal taxes, but the custom house officials were directly responsible to the Roman government for the duty on the exports and imports of the country. They also received tolls from users of the roads and bridges, from the boats which used the harbour facilities, and from the merchants who traded in the markets. Travellers entering or leaving Capernaum would have to stop at the custom house, unload their mules or camels, and subject their merchandise to the keen eyes of the customs official, who would require duty which ranged from 2.5% to 12.5%, according to its nature. It will be readily seen that these officials had numerous opportunities for bribery and extortion, and there can be little doubt that most of them used these means to amass quick fortunes, enjoy their power and the patronage of those wealthy families to whom they granted immunities which were denied to the poor. As we should expect, the scribes and Pharisees were particularly opposed to all publicans. Once perforce they had to admit them into their synagogues, they lost no occasion of showing their distaste and contempt. Should any synagogue official ever succumb to the temptation of getting a more lucrative living by joining the publicani, he was forthwith expelled from his duties. Sitting day by day outside his custom house, Matthew would undoubtedly see and hear much of Jesus. He would see the steady procession constantly moving down the wide paved road towards Capernaum, from the poor, homeless, wanderers to the impressive caravans of the rich with their attendants. He would see the sick and the halt and the blind carried and led towards the place where Jesus was preaching. Ships would come across the lake bringing their burden of people eager to join the throng. He would answer the countless questions that would be breathlessly put to him concerning the present whereabouts of the prophet. He would, without a doubt, have been personally acquainted with Peter and Andrew, James and John, and would have heard, perhaps with amazement, possibly with understanding, that they had left their homes and their trade to be the disciples of the prophet Jesus. There were probably times when, moving along the shore, Jesus would stop to heal and preach within sight and sound of Matthew's roadside custom house, and amid repeated interruptions he would hear many of the gracious words that Jesus spoke, and see a pale face change to a healthy glow under his touch, and a raving madman become calm and joyful at a word of command. He would be strangely impressed by the contrast between the teaching he listened to and the law-bound repetitions of the scribes, by the way in which he ministered to the lowest and meanest suppliant, people from whom the scribes would have shrunk in horror. He would be encouraged to hope that with this man there would be sympathy and encouragement, where everywhere else there was bitterness and scorn. Then, because of his unique position, he would be one of the first to learn that all was not well between Jesus and the religious rulers in Capernaum. They were his enemies too, and he would feel a bond of fellowship with this gracious teacher. And so it seems very probable that gradually, all unknown to himself, Matthew became in spirit a disciple of Jesus, but a disciple who could never acknowledge his allegiance or hope for the favour of the Master he watched with growing eagerness. But on this morning, Jesus paused when he reached the custom house. His shadow fell athwart Matthew's desk. Looking up, Matthew met eyes of ineffable love, which conveyed to him the message even before the lips could utter the words, "Follow me." And the man who during long years had become hardened to angry words and bitter looks left the parchments and the money chest in the roadside cabin to become first a disciple and then an apostle. The official who for so long had added to men's burdens was about to enter into the intimate service of him whose life's work was to remove them. Instead of his pen being inspired by selfish gain to record transactions in his ledger, it was to be his gracious privilege, inspired by the Spirit of God, to open a new account in the record of the eternal purpose of the Father, as now revealed in the life and the words of his beloved Son. The call of Matthew is a striking example of the complete disregard of Jesus for the opinions of men. It also illustrates how he quietly pursued a course which, from a logical point of view, could only do his cause a great deal of harm. There can be no doubt that the dramatic choice of Matthew led to a deterioration of the people's opinion of him, as well as a hardening of the opposition of the scribes and Pharisees. From the point of view of his ability to keep the support of the people and alleviate the disapproval of the religious rulers, it would have seemed much wiser to have ignored Matthew and accepted the scribe who was prepared to follow him whithersoever he went. But Jesus had the perspective of the ages. He knew that his work was only beginning with the completion of his earthly mission. His choices and decisions were based upon the future as much as the present. This is one of the less easily recognized and more difficult paths along which his disciples are called. It is only after long association that we can make mature judgments which are based upon the true recognition that the things that are seen are temporal and the things that are not seen are eternal. That Matthew was a comparatively wealthy man can be gathered from the great feast which he arranged at his house following his call. It was a gesture which affords us a glimpse of his character, because the guests he invited to meet Jesus were his fellow publicans. The occasion was both a farewell and an invitation. It marked the end of his life of affluence and the beginning of a life of poverty. But he was quick to recognize that in reality it was exactly the opposite. And we can believe that he was anxious that his former associates would be similarly persuaded when they met his master and made a renunciation like his. Jesus came to the feast accepting this expression of gratitude gladly, knowing its source and its object. As in all things, he judged the heart, but others were not so charitable. The event did not escape the notice of the local scribes and Pharisees, and with a cunning which reflects little credit upon them, they approached the disciples, realizing, no doubt, the harm they could do to Jesus by sowing disquiet in their minds. "How is it that he eateth with publicans and sinners?" the master did not allow his immature disciples to be exposed to the subtlety of these men. As was his custom then, so it is his promise now, that he will intervene in these crises of challenge and persecution. And we are thankful to his enemies, not because of their opposition, but because they evoked this gracious reply of Jesus on behalf of his disciples. His defence for loving the unloved is among the most beautiful of all the things which Jesus uttered, full of heavenly pleading and exquisite pathos. None can bring out the character of a man better than his enemies. And here, as so often in the Gospels, the sheer beauty of Christ shines forth as he answered these scowling, unfriendly men who seek only his humiliation. In their blindness and perversion, they question the company he keeps. With simple dignity, he assures them that this is his rightful place. He was a doctor, and no doctor worthy of the name would spend his time among the healthy. His true place was with his patients, and the more serious the illness, the longer he would be with them, and the more frequent his visits. A complete answer to their challenge, it was also an indictment of those who made it. It exposed as bad physicians those who had been given the responsibility of healing. Instead of strengthening the weak, they avoided contact with those who needed their help and were in obvious fear of infection. But there was far more in his answer than this for those who would thoughtfully consider its implications. It provided the true interpretation of his healing work among the bodily sick. All men were guilty in God's sight and worthy of death. In his grace, the Eternal Father was pleased to give that guilt another name and call it sickness. But it was still a sickness unto death, and it could only be cured by the physician of God's provision. Thus, when Matthew records the healing of Peter's wife's mother, he adds, that it might be fulfilled, which was spoken by Isaiah the prophet, saying, himself took our infirmities and bare our sicknesses. Yet deliverance was not complete until God sealed it in the wounds of his beloved Son. Jesus was careful not to accept the postulate of their question. The obvious inference they made was that they were righteous. Go and learn what that meaneth. I will have mercy and not sacrifice. For I am not come to call the righteous, but sinners to repentance. The object of Jesus in making this quotation from Hosea will be seen when we too go and learn what it meaneth. The message of this prophet, as indeed of all the prophets of Israel, was the sickness of Israel, an indication of their punishment, and a glimpse of the restoration which would finally be granted in the mercy of God. None but the God of Israel could accomplish this, and then only in the greatness of his loving kindness. Thus the Spirit through Hosea says, the Assyrian could not heal them, but the healing would come. And the word comes to the prophet, I will heal their backsliding, I will love them freely, for mine anger is turned away from him. In the sixth chapter, where we are given a prophetic insight into the new covenant, when the mercy of God will be manifest to Israel, words which point with wonderful significance to the death and resurrection of the Messiah are prefaced by Israel's acknowledgement of her sin and God's ability to heal. Come, and let us return to the Lord, for he hath torn and he will heal us. He hath smitten and he will bind us up. If only those scribes and Pharisees had obeyed the Lord's injunction and meditated upon the words to which he directed them, they would have learned that they were in dire need of the physician. They needed him more. Their sickness was greater than the publicans because of their faithlessness to their trust. This exchange between Jesus and the local synagogue officials was followed by an interruption from the disciples of John the Baptist. It is possible that their question was inspired by the Pharisees. A certain affinity seems implied by their challenge. And there is a footnote here, which says, "We cannot rule out the possibility that when John was imprisoned, many of his disciples turned to the Pharisees." To continue, "Why do we and the Pharisees fast oft, but thy disciples fast not?" With beautiful appropriateness, Jesus led them back to their own master's words, words which each of them would remember because they were so often repeated by the prophet who now languished in prison. "Ye yourselves," John had said, "bear me witness that I said, I am not the Christ, but I am sent before him." Jesus identified himself with John's words. He was the bridegroom. His disciples had recognized and acclaimed him, and because he was still with them, it was an hour for rejoicing and not for fasting. But the bridal feast was not yet. The bridegroom must leave his disciples alone. That would be their time of sorrow and fasting. Jesus sealed his argument by the two metaphorical parables of the garment and the wine, both associated with the bridegroom. "No man," he said, "putteth a piece of new cloth into an old garment." The ceremonial fasting of the Pharisees and of John's disciples was a part of an old system that was ready to vanish away. It had been superseded by the arrival of the bridegroom, who had come to consecrate a new and living way. The garment which is worn out to the point of uselessness cannot be made serviceable again. The new material will only emphasize its poverty. And then, as his manner was, Jesus changed the figure and deepened the truth he was expressing. "No man putteth new wine into old bottles." The garment had only to do with the outward aspect. Now Jesus turns to something which affects the inward condition. His mission from God as the physician and the bridegroom was to turn a deathly heritage into an eternal one. But this great gift could not be received in the unregenerate, darkened life. A transformation had to take place, gradual, painful, and unmistakable. Jesus conceded that men do not straightway desire the new. They say the old is better. It is the cry of the flesh clinging desperately to its natural inclinations. But when Christ truly enters, it becomes a despairing cry in the light of the recognition that the flesh profiteth nothing, that his words are spirit and life. Thus graphically Jesus anticipated in this parable the words of his great apostle to the Gentiles. "If any man be in Christ, he is a new creature. Old things are passed away. Behold, all things are become new." Chapter 7. The Lord of the Sabbath. During this period of activity in and around Capernaum, Jesus came into open conflict with the Pharisees on the question of the Sabbath day. It was inevitable that it should come sooner or later, and the amazing popularity of Jesus, together with his complete answer to their charges and criticisms before the multitudes, led them to watch him with the utmost care. If they could find something in which they could irrevocably condemn him, they would restore their damaged prestige and also do his cause a great deal of harm. The Sabbath offered them the best opportunity to do this, because although he always attended the synagogue to worship, he was also prepared to continue with his ministry of healing. Walking through the cornfield with their Lord one Sabbath day, the disciples paused to eat some ears of ripening corn. Several times during these active days, when Jesus moved unweariedly among the people, teaching and healing, neither he nor his disciples had the opportunity to pause long enough for a meal. The Pharisees were carefully watching for such an opportunity. There was no Sabbath calm and reverence in their hearts. Scarcely had the disciples begun to eat than their Lord was challenged, "Behold, thy disciples do that which is not lawful to do on the Sabbath day." Jesus could so easily have turned upon them with withering scorn and exposed their littleness. He could have pointed out to them that his disciples were perfectly justified by the law of God, but had only broken their puny tradition. But if these men in their hatred had disclosed their ignorance of the significance of the Sabbath, Jesus had not. His shining example emphasized the meanness of their quibbles. Mercy still prevailed over judgment, giving his enemies a further span to see the error of their ways. With all the persuasion of sweet reasonableness, Jesus dealt with their accusation. He called upon the law and the prophets to justify the actions of his disciples. What would be your attitude towards King David and his followers who, like my disciples, hungered on the Sabbath? He went into the house of God and took the showbread which it was only lawful for the priests to eat. He did not ignore a tradition. He broke the law of God. And would you find fault with the priests who, in the execution of their duties, profane the Sabbath? But as he so often did on such occasions, he widened and deepened the context and gave a new meaning to the whole conception of the Sabbath. The Sabbath was made for man, and not man for the Sabbath. The Son of Man is Lord even of the Sabbath day. In sublimely simple words, Jesus did far more than defend his disciples. He went back beyond the law to the divine purpose in instituting the Sabbath. It was not a burden imposed upon man, but a blessing bestowed upon him. Like sacrifice, it was not ordained to give man the opportunity of doing something to show his goodness, but rather to give him the consciousness both of his need and of the divine provision to meet it. Its immediate significance was in rest for the body and solace for the spirit. The Pharisees had failed to understand even that proximate end. They had brought low this beneficent Lord of God by introducing innumerable restrictions which showed how much they had lost the spirit of God's dealings and indeed of his character. Under their heavy hand, the Sabbath had become an intolerable burden. When a life is dedicated to God, its purpose steadfast and its motive pure, the man-made restrictions to attain legal righteousness become not only irksome and unnecessary, but positively harmful. The whole teaching of Jesus created the incentive to seek and to love God. In doing so, he freed men from impositions which at their best could be but a poor substitute for true piety and morality. and at their worst could encourage the grossest self-esteem and hypocrisy. The denial of these ordinances did not prevent adequate expression of spiritual life. Rather, it cleared the way for it. Jesus gave incentive and power to a holiness and consecration undreamed of in the law. He demonstrated it by his own radiant example. He showed that response to God's love lay not in the bondage of the letter, but in the liberty of the Spirit. This fundamental conception was the great gulf that was fixed between Jesus and the religious rulers of his day. The things that the scribes and Pharisees taught had become the acknowledged standard of religious life. Jesus exposed them as the great evil of his time, forming a barrier between man and the true knowledge and worship of God. The conflict was not as inevitable as it was bitter. It had of necessity to be unto death. If only these men had forgotten their littleness for a moment, if in the light of his words they had dispassionately viewed their charge against the disciples, they could hardly have failed to perceive that it was almost laughable. They were not accusing them of taking the corn. That was permissible. But according to the mature judgment they were enforcing, the action of rolling the ears between their hands constituted the process of threshing. It was because their minds were full of this pettiness that they were unprepared for the revelation which followed. But I say unto you, that in this place is one greater than the temple. The priests ministered in the temple on the Sabbath. Both Sabbath and a temple must give way to one who is greater than either, and he is standing in their midst. The Sabbath is not an end in itself. It is typical of a rest that remaineth for the people of God. The temple was but an evidence of the condescension of the Almighty to the limitations of men. Its chief significance lay in its essentially prophetic character, pointing forward to the time when the tabernacle of God shall be with men, and he will dwell with them. Both these features were dependent upon God's purpose of redemption in Christ. He was thus higher than both, Lord of the Sabbath and greater than the temple. One of the great tragedies of that and every age is that men and women are so preoccupied with their real or imagined rights and privileges that the great revelations of God which hath power to transform their whole lives are unheeded. It is an evil which can have its victims in the household. At times when the rights and wrongs of an issue are the subject of heated discussion, it is always wise to pause and listen to the voice of Christ. He can restore the true perspective. However complete a truth, and however sublime a teacher, men's understanding is blunted when their hearts are darkened by malice and evil. The following Sabbath found the scribes and Pharisees watching with unabated intensity. All eyes were upon Jesus as he entered the synagogue and approached a man whose hand was withered. Would he dare to break the Sabbath law before them all in the house of God? Jesus knew their thoughts and deliberately chose to make the issue clear beyond the slightest doubt. Turning to the afflicted man, he commanded him to rise and stand forth in their midst. Then he challenged them, "I will ask you one thing. Is it lawful on the Sabbath days to do good or to do evil? To save life or to destroy it? What man shall there be among you that shall have one sheep, and if it fall into a pit on the Sabbath day, will he not lay hold on it and lift it out? How much then is a man better than a sheep? His questions went unanswered. No man spoke. Impervious alike to his pleading and to the need of the man whose arm hung helplessly at his side, they waited for him to act so that they might accuse him. Jesus looked upon them with anger in his heart at their unrelenting hardness. This was the spirit which would dog his footsteps through Galilee and Judea, endeavouring to thwart every gesture of love. It would not bend to the warmth of Christ's pleading, but eventually it would break under the heavy blows of Rome. But his anger turned to love as he turned from them to the suppliant who waited eagerly for his healing power. Stretch forth thine hand. Obedience brought restitution to the sufferer and frustration to the enemies of Jesus. They went away, anger crystallizing into settled hatred and envy. They held a council and even consorted with the Herodians. Their one preoccupation was how they might destroy him. Their persistence, which was at last to win its terrible reward, is a bitter commentary upon the depravity of the human spirit. It is also a wonderful revelation of the grace of God, shining through his beloved Son, that when Jesus heard of the evil counsels, he withdrew himself. And when great multitudes followed him, he healed them all.